Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Dr. Reggie Williams, associate professor of Christian ethics at McCormick Theological Seminary. I recently read Dr. Williams' book, Bonhoeffer's Black Jesus, Harlem Renaissance Theology and an Ethic of Resistance, and was moved by its look at Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his time in the United States in 1930, specifically his time in Harlem at Abyssinian Baptist Church. April 9th, 1945 was the date that Bonhoeffer was killed in a German concentration camp, so I thought it was a good time to speak to Dr. Williams about one of the 20th century's most famous theologians and dissidents. I hope you enjoy it. Dr. Reggie Williams, thank you so much for joining me on the Failing Boldly podcast.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
I always like to start with folks in talking about their upbringing, particularly for folks who are in a religious field. And so I'm interested in your own story. Did you grow up thinking that teaching and writing would be part of your either vocation or as a way to live out any kind of call that you might have felt in your own life?
Not at all. If someone had told me that I would be a professor, if you told me this 15, 20 years ago, I'd have known for sure that you were crazy. This was not on the radar at all. I had a pretty clear plan when I was in high school. If I made it to college, I was going to go to a junior college, a very competitive basketball junior college. Then I was going to make it to Georgetown University, play basketball there at Georgetown University for the famous coach who was there at the time, whose name escapes me at the
moment. John Thompson.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I was going to play for John Thompson. And then I was going to make it to Chicago and play for the Bulls. I had it all mapped out.
That's a good plan.
Yeah. None of it included the academy.
Okay.
I did make it. I went to a very competitive junior college. Then I transferred to another. I had change of heart, and I wanted to be able to pray with my basketball coach. So at the time, I did what I knew and went to a Christian college because I was going to where I thought was what a Christian. I mean, that was the kind of Christianity that I was familiar with. Wasn't the kind of Christianity that I would say is most beneficial now, having been through that school. But I mean, that's a whole nother box to open up.
Yeah. So what shifted then? What were the moments when the basketball route didn't quite plan out and you decided to go a different path?
Well, I did make it to play professionally. I played overseas.
Okay.
I played in Australia. I played there for one season. During that season, we had a surprise pregnancy. My son, our firstborn came into the world, he was very sick. We needed specialized medicine. We had Kaiser insurance in California. Saved his life. Literally saved his life. We had no idea what we didn't know. Had no idea what we didn't know. But we had the right insurance. When my wife found herself pregnant in Australia very quickly, the insurance treated it as a pre-existing condition there. The team was covering it, and some friends of ours, while we were there, gave birth. My wife saw that, and she said, I'm not having this kid here. So I had to hang the shoes up. And I did my best, made sure that when we got back to to the area where our son was born, had the same insurance. She was born with the same doctor, our daughter was, right across the hall from where our son was born in the same hospital. We had everything all set up and we didn't need it, thank God. But that was the end for me of my career after a season. It took me 2 years in therapy to get over that. But it was after that that I made a decision that I wanted to do something. I felt like I wanted to do something that leaves a mark. So I'd always had it in mind to go to seminary, but it wasn't because I was going to be a professor. I had no idea, but I was aiming high because my dream was gone.
So entering seminary, then thinking of being a pastor in a local church, or did you know at that point where that would lead you?
I had no idea it would lead me. Mm. Initially, my junior college basketball coach said, just get a master's degree and come and replace me as coach at the junior college, because all you need is a master's degree. And then while I was in my while I was in the master's program, the rules changed in California, and you had to have a degree that matched the field of study that you were heading into, which as the department that you would be in within the public school system, which the junior college was. That meant that I needed a kinesiology degree, not a theology degree. So because I was in seminary, that ruled me out from being the basketball coach at the junior college that I had attended and that I'd wanted to go to. So I just kept going. That was it. Through the master's program, at least. I still kept going. And then near the end of my master's program, the thought occurred to me, the possibility of going forward. But, you know, there's something that happens with there's something that Carter G. Woodson talks about, the miseducation of the Negro. There's something that happens to us, to black people, in the academy when we don't see ourselves represented in the classroom as professor, in those positions, in the academy. I thought from high school that higher education was for white people only. Mm. In high school, I thought that white kids go to college. I saw Spike Lee's School Days. It was about HBCUs, and I wanted to go to Grambling. My junior college, my high school counselor said that I wasn't really college material. Hmm. So I didn't even take the SATs, but I wanted to play basketball, so I walked onto a junior college basketball team, only for basketball. And then while I was there, I wanted to keep playing. That's how I ended up at this Christian college, but the Christian college was both Christian and it was one of the top 25 winningest college basketball coaches in the country at the time. He's now works in the front office for the Miami Heat. Hmm. His name is Chet Kammer. While I was there at Westmont, things changed around for me a bit. Of course, I went off and played professional basketball for a short time afterwards, but I still had questions. So I was interested in seminary. I ended up at Fuller because of proximity. They had an extension campus in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
And I just moved my family back from Australia. My wife just given birth. You know, the idea, it was all within a year. We moved back to San Jose, my wife gave birth. And then within that year, we moved to Santa Barbara, where I was working at Westmont. It worked out an arrangement with them. And then, you know, I started looking at seminaries and I thought, it just is not right to move them again. Mm-hmm. So we stayed and went to the extension site. I did, for Fuller in Santa Barbara.
Okay. And that's where you got your PhD?
I did a master's degree there. And I was starting to say that in my last year of my master's program, the only African American professor, this is why I was saying that I hadn't seen someone like me in that position throughout the entirety of my career in seminary training. The only African-American professor I had was an adjunct during the summer at Fuller. He said after class, just before class was over with a two-week intensive, on the last day of that intensive, I had turned in my final paper early, very early. He read it, came back to class that day after reading it, pulled me into the hallway and said, are you in a PhD program? And I said, no. I was thinking, does he think I plagiarized that? He said, I read your paper. You ought to be. You need to be. Those are his exact words. You ought to be. You need to be. If you don't do it, it'll be a mistake. He pushed me really hard. That was Reverend Dr. J. Alfred Smith from Allen Temple Baptist Church in Oakland, California. I call him Papa Doc now. That was the push that I needed. Yeah. So I only applied to one school, just the one that he was working at.
Let's talk about your book, Bonhoeffer's Black Jesus, Harlem Renaissance Theology and an Ethic of Resistance. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I'm glad I'm able to talk to you this month is that February is the birth month of Bonhoeffer. And right. So I'm interested first, of course, at what interested you about him and his life, and particularly what interested you in his experience in Harlem in the time when he was living and going to school in the United States?
When I was a master's student, I took a course on theology and art. As a final project in that course, I did a project on, I did a study on a major artist of the Harlem Renaissance, Aaron Douglas. When I got into a PhD program, my mentor, Glenn Stassen, asked me to be a TA for him in a course he was teaching on Bonhoeffer. I hadn't studied Bonhoeffer much, but it was during that TA, during the work as his TA, that I saw that Bonhoeffer was in New York during the Harlem Renaissance. I knew about the Harlem Renaissance time period because of my work with Aaron Douglas. Mm. Glenn emphasized New York as hugely influential for Bonhoeffer. As Bonhoeffer said in 1943 in a letter, that he hadn't changed much except for first influences of his father's personality. His father's a really strong personality. And then he said, after my first trip abroad, I was changed a lot. I mean, this is kind of in the parentheses. It was then that I changed from, and I'll paraphrase, from abstract to concrete in his Christianity. And scholars debate what did he mean? First trip abroad, when was that? It seems clear to me from research, the first trip abroad was to New York. Why did New York have such a huge impact on him? My mentor said it was because he was, Glenn would say it was because of his time at Abyssinian Baptist. That was significant. But Abyssinian was in Harlem. Harlem was happening, was having this significant, this watershed moment in African-American history. That's what interested me in studying him. I wanted to study in my PhD program the way that our understanding of Jesus shapes our morality as Christians, the central figure of our faith. Bonhoeffer's time in New York had an impact on him as a Christ-centered theologian. You read about his time in New York, which is volume 10 of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Work Series, and there's all of this stuff about New York, back and forth, writing, and who he's talking with, and what he's reading, and the impact that it has on him. Later, he's talking about it. He continues to talk about it. He comes back for a short time in 1939. So there was nothing written substantially about New York for him. Hmm. Nothing. And I think that's in part because Bonhoeffer scholars really struggle to talk about race. Hmm. They talk about anti-Semitism. But if one is to say that anti-Semitism is in fact a form of white supremacy, it's racism. Racism invokes another category. It invokes black-white. Do you see the Jewish question in Nazi Germany as an element of that black-white racial conversation, which in fact it is? But to recognize that Bonhoeffer is engaging white supremacy in Nazi Germany orients one on his own experience with white supremacy, which you recognize he's getting educated on this in Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance. Mm.
Can you refresh my memory of not only reading your book, but a couple of others too, but how much did he, in either his letters and his own writings, reduce self-reflection and publish or share with others about what he was experiencing in Harlem? If I remember correctly, there's not a lot, but am I wrong on that, or is there more than we realize?
There's more than we realize. Okay. It's letters home during his time there. I mean, he's writing his brother Carl Friedrich often. He's writing his grandmother. These personal letters. And then there are these small instances that show up when he comes back from New York as well, where he's writing a friend of his that he met in New York, a guy named Erwin Sutz, who was a Swiss fellow exchange student at Union Seminary. He talks to Erwin Sutz about his meeting with Karl Barth for the first time. And Karl Barth's students are really snooty. And Bonhoeffer is kind of sarcastically talking about how they have a nose for thoroughbreds. He slips in this phrase, he says, no Negro passes for white. Negro passing for white. The passing, this is a huge theme in the Harlem Renaissance. He knows the I mean, this is clearly a phrase he gets from Black New York. Mm-hmm. Later, he's talking with a group of young boys in a confirmation class that he's teaching in this rough part of Berlin. He's good with kids. And as when he meets them for the first time, they're really noisy, banging on the stairway banister as he's climbing it. He stops. The man who leads him to meet these kids just kind of shrinks away because he can't control the kids. Bonhoeffer leans back against the wall and is letting them go on. Then he leans over and talks to this kid in front of him quietly in the kid's ear. Everybody else leans in to listen. And he tells his friend, Erwin Sutz again, that he told them stories of Harlem. And if they were quiet and behaved, next time he would tell them more. Hmm. He's, of course, he's been writing his brother. He while he's in New York, he writes his brother while he's coming back from Cuba during Christmas break, and he's on a train. He's writing about how incredible it is, and he doesn't use that in a positive way, the race problem in the United States and the South, and how even the pastors are no different than any other. He reports to the superintendent for the church program that he's being ordained in, that sent him over to New York. He writes a report to them twice, Church Federation Office. In both reports, he includes segments on his experience in New York. Really insightful, too, about the impact that it has on him. Later, in 1942, he's writing a book that was posthumously published as Ethics. He includes in that essay, in that book, interaction with the Scottsboro Nine, case of nine Black young men who were accused of raping a white woman in Scottsboro, Alabama, I believe. When he was in New York, he wrote somebody from the Lutheran Church in Germany to join in the international protest around this case. He got a response from an official of the church saying that's a political issue, and we deal with theological issues. He was really upset about that. 1942, he's still thinking about it, and he includes it in this book that he's writing. In 1939, he comes over to the United States, only for a short time, comes back. While he's in New York, however, he starts writing this essay called The Church and the Jewish Question, finishes it when he comes back to Germany, and he includes a section on the Black church that he's thoroughly investigated. So there are lots, that's some of the things.
Yeah.
But he's clearly been impacted by this time.
Yeah. He seems to be one of those individuals where people from wherever you are in a theological spectrum, people lay claim to him and either admire him or quote him and sometimes want to claim him for their side, whether that's conservative or progressive or wherever. What is it about him and his life that inspires people, moves people to connect to him in that way?
Hitler is somebody that most everybody in their right minds recognizes as a clear wrong. Mm-hmm. Everybody would like to be that person who recognizes clear wrong, even though the majority of society in Germany went along with him. The person to have the insight to say that they recognize wrong when they see it. Bonhoeffer embodies, he is that person who was able to be clear about wrong in a sea of folks who couldn't. So they see themselves in him.
Yeah.
He becomes an avatar for people who feel strongly about their positions wherever they are at. Some of the scholars do that. But they do that with a lot of people.
Okay.
Martin Luther King Jr. is an avatar for a lot of different people. There was a Tea Party movement that had a rally on the Mall in Washington where King delivered his "I Have a Dream" speech. On the anniversary of the "I Have a Dream" speech, claiming King, who was another one of those figures representing movement that people would today say was the right thing in so much evil in the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the way that you talked about the necessity for Bonhoeffer to spend time at Abyssinian Baptist Church. He got involved in lots of different ways, teaching Sunday school, visiting homes. The lawyer, writer, prophet Brian Stevenson talks about the need for us to get proximate in our lives. And it seems to me that this is the case for Bonhoeffer too, for him to experience something that he'd never experienced before. Would you say that that's one way of looking at it, that his getting proximate with those who lived in Harlem and at Abyssinian Baptist enabled him to transform his worldview?
Yes. I would say that it significantly helped. Let's say what it didn't do. It did not make him aware that racism was a real thing. They had racism in Germany. Mm-hmm. They had black-white racism in Germany. Germany was a colonial power. And it was, as scholars of German colonialism will tell us, Germanism, excitement of over, or I should say, or longing for pure Germanic race, was not new with the Nazis. It had been there for a while. So he wasn't new to that. That's an important thing to recognize for people who look at Bonhoeffer. Race was common in Germany. But as a wealthy, very well-educated, white, young German attending a black church, seeing racism not from the perspective of the Germanic, but from somebody who is a target of white supremacy, was influential for him. Mm-hmm. And that's clear. To see the perspective of a society longing for white space, pure white space, and even using their Christianity as theological logic for that longing, you know, to undergird that is a good thing. He encountered another kind of theological learning. I would say that what is common in the United States is that theology comes across the Atlantic Ocean from west to east, Germany to the U.S. Bonhoeffer ends up having a reverse in that flow. He takes theologically what he encounters in Harlem back to Germany. Mm. And it opens up what's happening there in a way that would not have been possible for him were it not for encountering black Christians in Harlem.
And the importance, too, of rather than reading about them, for example, but actually to being there in their lives. And you, in your book, you quote the pastor at the time at Abyssinian Baptist, Adam Clayton Powell, as saying, faith consists more in doing than it does in believing. And then later on in the book, this is a quote from you, Bonhoeffer's theology became a passionate articulation of his faith rather than a demonstration of his intellect. And I guess, again, I go back to being there in the midst of seeing how their faith is lived out seemed like it was influential for him.
Right. Now, he'd made an emphasis on the social implications of faith, of theology. That was his dissertation. And his second dissertation, actually called Habilitation Schrift. The effort of his project was to describe a Christian concept of person. Now, without getting into the weeds on that, he wants to say that you will know somebody from the behavior, I mean, you know Jesus from what Jesus does in addition to who Jesus is. This is basically what he's writing about. But it seems apparent to me that that's a very local effort to help the country recover in the context of shame. That this Jesus wasn't much more than a representation of a German longing for recovery until he gets into New York. I think these are developments in his faith that happen out there. And Powell sounds a lot like him, but doing it differently. I found a sermon that Powell preached while Bonhoeffer was there. It was the Great Depression. While Bonhoeffer was there, that was happening there, and Powell was doing this. His church was doing this relief project in Harlem during the Great Depression. Powell was driving his very nice car, because the church is wealthy. He's driving his very nice car on Lenox Avenue, which is now Lenox Malcolm X Avenue, in Harlem. And he's seeing people destitute. I mean, as the saying goes, when white America gets a cold, black America gets pneumonia. And we're talking about the Great Depression here. They're destitute. Powell says, God, why don't you do something in prayer? He's upset about what he's seeing. He says that he was asleep one night after that, and he heard a voice say, Powell, why don't you do something? So he takes that as a call to action, preaches this sermon series, Naked God and the Hungry God, Matthew 25. In this, in the Hungry God, which is a piece of the transcript I found, he says, when we feed a hungry person, I'm paraphrasing, we feed God. We give clothes to someone. We clothe God. This would have made sense to Bonhoeffer, speaking from the language of Christ as God's vicarious representation. This is a major component of his theology. Mm-hmm. He uses the word Stellvertretung. Vicarious representation, so that when God, we in our sin and shame could not stand before God, Christ stands in for us, stands in for us. So Christ stands in for us before God, before our neighbor, in our encounters. So we're always encountering Christ. Powell says that when you give clothes to someone, you're giving clothes to God. Mm-hmm. Christ. This resonates. It's not a local nationalist claim. The folk here, this is whomever you encounter. Mm-hmm. What does this mean for the white supremacist who claims to be Christian and shuns and hurts and harms?
Yeah.
They're doing that to Christ.
Yeah. And this seems to tie in to your description of empathy in the book, mm-hmm. and what you call abusive empathy. And so I'm wondering if you could unpack that a little bit, how you describe that in the book, the empathy and abusive empathy, and how it affected Bonhoeffer.
So empathy is to experience something that is more descriptive of an other's reality than my own. I may be able to sense or carry or feel with someone who's experiencing something that I'm not actually experiencing. That may come from my experience of the same kind of trauma or whatever it may be. When I was writing my dissertation, I came across a book by a man named Martin Hoffman, Empathy. And I'm looking at it on my bookshelf. It's something along the lines of empathy and its implications for social justice. He uses the phrase empathic distress. I liked the concept because I'm seeing something happening in someone else, a struggle there. Mm-hmm. And I have this distress. I feel distress until their struggle is relieved. That would be a healthy empathy. And an unhealthy empathy is where I take over that identity. I take on their experience as though it is my own. And there are ways that can be done in a healthy manner. to help someone get through something. But if I don't have the ability to see myself anymore, that's unhealthy, as distinct from them. Another way empathy could be unhealthy is when I see them going through that situation, but I cannot imagine myself behaving as they're behaving in it. And so it diminishes their humanity. A scholar named Sadia Hartman talks about this in a book she's published called Scenes of Subjection. When the slave coffle, this is a group of enslaved black people being led to the auction. And the one leading them forces them, before they get out in the public, warns them to step lively and look happy. Okay. They even have a fiddle player playing alongside them as they are skipping off to the auction block under threat of bodily harm. The empathic abolitionist looking at them skip and step lively cannot imagine him or herself smiling should they be in that situation. So empathy in that context then turns into a way of dehumanizing those people because maybe they're fit for that. If I imagine myself in their shoes, what I see happening there is illegible to me. Doesn't make sense to me, mm-hmm. but I feel for them. How do I read an other's reaction to their trauma? Empathy doesn't. It can be harmful. It may not tell me everything that I'm needing to know about what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
That's an abuse of empathy.
How would you then characterize the way Bonhoeffer experienced empathy?
So, when I was writing that, I was imagining Bonhoeffer coming from a context of shame, entering into a context of people who have an inferior identity imposed upon them. I wouldn't call it shame, because though society says X, Y, and Z about black people, these black people knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly knew who they were. But so in that case, it's not shame for them that Bonhoeffer may have shared, but a sense of we maintain pride in identity in spite of what the outside world says of us. There's some of that. But even beyond that, what's most important of what Bonhoeffer did is that he entered into that context, seeing himself as somebody different, but learning from them. That's one of the things empathy can do for us. Allowing us, if we allow ourselves yet to see ourselves still, but to enter into another context where we are open to being changed.
Mm-hmm.
To see the world as it is perceived from someone else while I'm in proximity to them. See the world through someone else's lens, entering into an other's context with eyes and ears open. That's an empathic kind of move.
Yeah.
Because I can inhabit somebody else's shoes, not to move their body around for them, but simply to share in what learning learning is happening with them. In this case, not so much learning is happening. He's experiencing the world as they see it,
mm-hmm.
as best as possible,
right?
Because he still has his own history that informs what he's seeing to some degree, it's also important to recognize he didn't figure it out. He was able to get something while he was there, but what he got didn't tell him the whole story. He was still Dietrich Bonhoeffer, educated, wealthy, white, European, longing for a reinvigorated Western world. That was not a black longing. people who were familiar with the impact of colonialism aren't so warm on colonialism. But Bonhoeffer still remained tethered to a view of an ascendant Western world.
Okay. I realize whenever looking at the life of a martyr, and I know it's too simplistic to talk about their life as either quote unquote a success or quote unquote a failure, mm-hmm. but I'm curious how you, after he went back to Germany, and as you think about his life and the impact his life has had, what would be ways that you would characterize his life and the impact that he had?
Ways of characterizing his life. In short, he was trying to be Christian. Hmm. That's one. He had some encounters that made him uncomfortable in a country where Christians were not holding the right things as dear to them. His dissertation had told him that it's only through an encounter with others, not a consumption of others, the encounter with others as other. It's only through encounter with other human beings that we encounter Christ. This was blown into not just a Germanic thing, the brother and sister, my folk, that we value each other and encounter Christ in each other, but this became whomever. So he had a set of, he had a recognition of Christian life that valued encountering others as encountering Christ in others. Germany, as he met it on the way after New York, was longing for a Germanic state and shunning others. Mm-hmm. That was a very different gospel. So his was a life of trying to live out a Christian life in the midst of an unfaithful Christian nation.
Yeah,
I would say that. Yep. Another thing that Bonhoeffer provides for us. It's courage. For a lot of people find in him courage. Could I face? I mean, as Bonhoeffer struggled as well, death, stare down death, holding tight to what I know to be the gospel. He asked a question while he was in prison, while he's writing a book. He said, what do we believe? What do we really believe so much that we would be willing to die for it? Now, people reading that, hearing that from him, hear something along the lines of a person who held on to their principles even in the face of an onslaught of an immoral country. But for Bonhoeffer, this is not so much about principles or abstract beliefs. Principles for him are the things that we hold on to that we can call ourselves good before we have encounters with other human beings where we are called to be faithful. It's only in the encounter with other human beings that we experience the life of Christ. That's a dynamic thing. So his willingness to go to his death had to do with more so with an insistence that Christ is in the world, and in the world we join in the sufferings and death of Christ. Mm. Not floating above it in this abstract sense of, you know, doctrine or belief.
How have you been changed by your encounter with his writings and going so deep into his life?
You know, I moved I'm moved by that simple faith. I'm very, very moved by that. And I got to say, you know, his theology certainly has shaped me. I'm doing some work on the way he was received by liberation theologians in South Africa. But that work to see others and ourselves in the encounter with others, it's not just Bonhoeffer. That's a very West African anthropology too. It's South African concept. Or I should say they have something like it in South Africa, in Ubuntu. In West Africa, you know, I am because we are type things. And it's that kind of stuff that helps to humanize. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about this too. So I think his articulation of it was ahead of his time in Germany. And though very common in other parts of the country, because it was ahead of his time and something that's known in these places that were not harmed by harmful Enlightenment thought, harmful stuff from the Enlightenment, he becomes the standout, the standout figure. But he's got an anthropology that's very African.
Okay. That's a good reminder.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you reflecting on that. I usually end these conversations, and you touched on this a little bit at the beginning when I asked you about the world of academia, but I always ask somebody to share a story of failure from their own life, and that can be personal, professional, something small, something big that formed them in their own life. So I was wondering if you could share a failure story from your own experiences.
Oh, man. Let's see. Gosh, I have several. There are two that come to mind. Maybe I'll share this one. Maybe I'll go back a bit. One time, when I was in seminary as a PhD student, threw some hot ashes in the trash. Woke up early in the morning to a raging. Woke up early in the morning to a raging fire. We had renters in a mother-in-law house in the back of this house in Pasadena, and it was. Looked like the fires were starting to lick the rooftop of that house. It was going to catch. I jumped up, threw something on quickly, ran out, got the hose, and was putting it out. My wife called the fire department. The fire department came, and I was automatically frightened of what was going to happen. I told them I didn't know how the fire started. And the couple that was there, I think they may have seen me put the ashes in the fireplace, or I had said that I had done that. I mean, in the trash can, I said that I'd done that. But I looked like a big liar in front of everybody, and it was because I was terrified. I had to give myself space to have made that mistake, and to not have that define me. Even though those folks were saying, he's a PhD student in ethics, he just lied to the fire department. That was a lie. I lied. And I came back to that later and said that. I apologized to them and to my wife. And most people hearing that are going to say, come on, man. Tell me something juicy or something bigger than that, because that seems pretty light. But yeah, that was a moral failure. One, I would say that, I don't do, you know, but it was one in which light enough as it was one still that I'd need to wrestle with the fact that I made a failure and that failure does not own me.
Yeah. And it sticks out. I mean, it's a memory. And so therefore it's important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One more. When I started teaching, I wanted my students in this Christian evangelical space where I was an adjunct professor. I wanted them to know that I knew I'm black. And I'm comfortable with that. I came into class wearing a dashiki, an African top, and blue jeans. Freaked them out. I set up the class where we started in this course on kind of thinking through why theological or why Christian education is important. I gave them a kind of a rudimentary run through ethics. This is what the class was as I designed it. We read Howard Thurman, Ida B. Wells Barnett, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. But we started off with Ida B. Wells Barnett, which would mean that they would have to engage her crusade against lynching. The class was primarily white. They got freaked out. I even showed them videotapes. I showed them a YouTube clip of this series of postcards from lynchings. Mm. So they saw lynched people on the screen. These freshmen, white evangelical freshmen, were so freaked out from the very moment they saw a black person in front of them in a dashiki, and I'm taking them through postcards of lynchings. By the time we got to Bonhoeffer, they were so freaked out, they could not learn anything else. Mm-hmm. And they reamed me on the evaluations, and it just was such a big failure. And my other colleagues were doing great. One particular white colleague always got stellar reviews, and I'm getting trashed, the lowest possible. And I had to reckon with how I would deal with this community as a professor. Mm. And I learned the difference between discomfort and anxiety in the classroom. Mm. That I had made those white students so anxious that they, and when you're anxious, it shuts down learning. If you're uncomfortable, that's the environment to learn.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, it should. Do I? I would say I was a failure to reach that class. That helped me. That helped me learn how to do teaching and presentations better.
Well, what a learning though to be able to not only name and recognize the difference between anxiety and discomfort, but then to be able to learn from it. And then I would imagine today you have a better sense of how to make students uncomfortable, not anxious.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
True.
Well, Dr. Reggie Williams, thank you so much for giving me your time today and sharing your reflections. I'm grateful for the work that you've done and that you continue to do.
Sure. Thank you.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Dr. Williams for giving his time for this conversation. You can follow him on Twitter at RegLWill, RegLWill. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast. And if you have a moment to go onto iTunes and give it a rating, I would appreciate it. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.